peace building.
We have to leave it there. David Vine, author of The United States of War. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
Your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, the fight over signs and flags in schools is getting more intense in Newburgh. New challenges to the legal right to abortion in the U.S. And Oregonians are getting ready for hundreds of Afghan refugees expected within weeks. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fund drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Washington County is the first in Oregon to reach an important milestone. This week, Governor Kate Brown went to a county vaccination clinic to praise local leaders for reaching 80% vaccinated against COVID-19. Since then, Multnomah County has also reached the 80% mark. Meantime, as Oregon students go back to learning in person, school district, teachers, and families want to find out what could trigger a reversal back to remote learning. So far, they have not gotten a firm number or metric from county health officials. And just today, a CDC panel's recommending Pfizer booster shots for many Americans, but not health workers. Scientific advisors are recommending the shots for tens of millions of older Americans and people with some medical conditions, but the panel excluded those at risk due to their jobs. That differs from the FDA's authorization this week, which does include health workers, teachers, and grocery workers, as well as everyone older than 65. Some big developments today in the legal battle over abortion rights in this country. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A Republican lawmaker in Florida is proposing a bill similar to the most restrictive abortion law in America. State Representative Webster Barnaby filed House Bill 167, the Florida Heartbeat Act, on September 22nd. It prevents physicians from performing abortions if there is a detectable fetal heartbeat, effectively banning the procedure 6 weeks into most pregnancies. The Texas law it has been compared to provides the ability to sue physicians performing an abortion. That ability to sue is a similar component in the Florida bill. The Supreme Court recently refused to block the Texas law from going into effect. A group of abortion providers and advocates has now asked the Supreme Court to quickly review their challenge to the highly restrictive Texas law. The petitioner's latest effort asked the Supreme Court to take up the case before a lower court issues its final ruling. There are significant medical issues with the proposed Florida law. The term fetus doesn't actually apply until 8 weeks into a pregnancy. The electrical activity detectable by ultrasound arises from cells that haven't yet formed a heart. The machine itself actually manufactures the heartbeat sound. Florida Democrats are harshly criticizing the proposed bill. State Representative Anna Eskamani says it attacks women and birthing people seeking an abortion. She feels politicians should not get involved between a person and their doctor. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Nikki Fried says the proposal turns Floridians against one another and is extreme. Adrian Kimmel, acting president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, was horrified to see anti-choice politicians in Florida following in Texas' footsteps. Kimmel believes there is no question lawmakers in other states will do the same, and that the harm of these laws most acutely impacts those who already face the greatest barriers to accessing care. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
In just 2 to 3 weeks, some 500 refugees from Afghanistan are expected at Portland International Airport. Groups that help refugees in Oregon are getting ready for what could be a record number of people coming to resettle in our area. Nami Bigos is with the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, or IRCO. This week, she told the East Portland Chamber of Commerce about the latest plans. And that was Nami Bigos, the fundraising coordinator. for IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, on the expected arrival of some 500 Afghan refugees in Oregon in the next few weeks.
I know that a lot of people have questions about Afghanistan and the incoming refugees that are slated to arrive in the next few weeks. A lot of you all work for government offices and may know more than I do. Our folks, yeah, I know, as much as any of us really know, I think for those of you who aren't on those kind of regular daily calls where the news is changing every day and really all we're dealing with are guesstimates, that because of that vague situation, IRCO is, many of the departments were planning on the sense of anticipation. So like the fundraising department, we're gathering funds, we're stockpiling supplies and waiting for the day we find out they arrived. You know, this morning we wake up to a text and are like, oh, they're all here, which I am going to guess is going to be the situation we find ourselves in. The best information that I can share is we should be receiving about 500 people, more or less, which is only 1% of the 50,000 people that were evacuated on behalf of the U.S. government. Right now, they're waiting in offshore refugee camps, I believe, based in Uganda and Dubai, before they're moved to Air Force bases here, and then folks are individually flown to their resettlement locations. The struggle that I know that we're dealing with is Portland's never received that many refugees at one time. And so the collective peer organizations are looking at different solutions we might end up having to build a temporary refugee camp at a very large scale while, you know, whether we need to do vaccine clinics, different training and education before folks are sent out to different apartment buildings, individual homes, or redistributed throughout the state. And our best guess is folks may arrive in 2 to 3 weeks. There's just a lot of unknown. I know our legal department is very, very busy working with individual people's paperwork and requests to try and get more people out of the country, whether it's to come to the United States or just leave the country, period. There's also the federal government changed a lot of the requirements and statutes around the paperwork to qualify to leave. Unfortunately, that was only really well communicated to people who specialize in immigration law. And due to the panic that the end of the war caused, friends and family were reaching out to just any lawyer they knew, naturally. And a lot of folks had incorrect paperwork filed. So I know that our immigration department is partnering with other immigration law firms to help educate the local lawyers with all the updates that are out of, you know, the Fed's office and while processing people's paperwork. And so we'll see. It's a busy time.
And that was Nami Bigos, the fundraising coordinator for IRCO, the Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, on the expected arrival of some 500 Afghan refugees in Oregon in the next few weeks. In other states, advocates are urging compassion and education as they're also getting ready for Afghan refugees. Mike Moen reports over the past two decades, North Dakota's resettled 115 Afghan refugees, and now they're getting ready for more.
In the near future, North Dakota is poised to help resettle 49 Afghan evacuees who fled their home country after the U.S. military exit. Those assisting in the effort, along with human rights advocates, call on local leaders and residents to fully welcome these individuals. The recent announcement came after North Dakota's resettlement office request for that number was approved by the U.S. State Department. Dan Hanaher of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service says the response has been positive so far, especially from the business community willing to hire new arrivals.
I heard from an employer saying, if you're receiving 49 Afghans, if 40 of them are employable, I'll take them all.
Most refugees are likely to be resettled in Fargo, and Hanaher says the area has enough affordable housing on that front. Advocates say the public should do its part to quell any hateful rhetoric that may arise while offering a welcoming tone. State officials say these individuals go through a rigorous vetting process and will be vaccinated against COVID. Darcy Ashe is with the New American Consortium, which also will assist with resettlement. She says the combination of compassion and services can help refugees establish roots and be contributors to the area. She adds that in this situation, the trauma they experienced will be fresh in their minds as they were sent to the U.S. more quickly than usual to be vetted.
Just being very conscientious of that, that the services that we provide are culturally appropriate, that there's language ability so that communication is done well.
Barry Nelson of the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition urges local leaders and community members to educate each other about the refugees and their needs. He feels there's already misinformation floating around, and he says Fargo's new hate crime ordinance should be utilized if needed.
Make sure that everything that needs to be done to eradicate it, to perhaps prosecute if needed, if it rises to that level, would happen.
State officials say the resettlement program is federally funded and that the effort doesn't impact social services currently available to North Dakotans in need. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Portland City Council will vote on whether to renew a five-year, $25 million contract with Downtown Clean and Safe. For some, Clean and Safe is a controversial city contractor because it's a private cleaning and security service that serves downtown Portland's enhanced service district. They clean graffiti, pick up trash, and provide security patrols. It's paid for by taxpayers in the district and is a subcontractor of the lobbying group, the Portland Business Alliance. The city collects the money to transfer to Clean and Safe. The contractor is accused of mistreating houseless Portlanders on public sidewalks in a scathing city audit from last year. Many are opposed to the contract renewal and say that the contract doesn't differ very much from what was in place before. Opponents also say that $25 million is too expensive and that 5 years is too long of a contract to offer. The attempt to address the claims of harassment of houseless people is to reduce security guards to 15 on shift at a time and only let a fourth carry weapons. The five-year contract renewal is introduced by Commissioner Mingus Mapps and Mayor Ted Wheeler. It's unclear yet where the rest of the commissioners land on the issue, though Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Carmen Rubio have expressed skepticism about the guards carrying weapons in the past. The Newburgh School Board heard plenty of public comments about their ban on Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ pride flags and clothing at school. Some on the board justified the ban, saying that the flags are political and too distracting for students. About 40 people offered public comments, with an even split as to whether they supported or opposed the ban. More than a dozen Newburgh School students spoke, all of them against the ban. Several also identify themselves as members of the LGBTQ community. Midas Jenkins is a transgender student at the Catalyst School who spoke at the meeting. Jenkins said, quote, "I have a firsthand experience of the difference that diligent expressions of support can make. I am not political. I am human," end of quote. Most of those who supported the ban did not make their connection to the school district clear or had been students in the district decades earlier. One man from McMinnville spoke at length about Black Lives Matter and Marxism while holding up a hand signal used by white supremacists. Mariah Reed was the 2019 valedictorian at Newburgh High School. Reed said, quote, never once did a student come with a concern that a BLM or pride flag was a threat to their learning. This culture war threatens the lives of students. There will be consequences to your actions. The blood of my peers will be on your hands. The board will meet again on September 28th. Local opposition to a proposed land swap near a lake was strong even before the Idaho Department of Lands rejected the deal. Now, as Eric Teganov reports, a coalition is proposing conserving the land.
After the rejection of a developer's proposed land swap near Payette Lake, a coalition of groups wants the state to do the opposite. The coalition United Payette submitted a proposal today to conserve more than 5,000 acres of endowment lands near the lake. The plan has support from Valley County, the nearby city of McCall, and Shoshone-Bannock tribes. Jonathan Oppenheimer with Idaho Conservation League says the surrounding community wanted to come up with a better solution than development.
Together, we've been working to develop this plan over the last several months and are hopeful that it will be well received and looking forward to working with the Department of Lands and the Land Board to see the project implemented and ultimately to see the lands around Payette Lake protected as public lands for future generations.
More than 1,200 people have signed a petition supporting the proposal. Triton asked the Idaho Board of Land Commissioners to rescind the Department of Land's decision and hold a contested case hearing, but the board unanimously rejected their requests this week. The Department of Land says Triton undervalued the land around the lake. The agency is constitutionally required to maximize returns on endowment lands, which generate money for public schools and other beneficiaries. Oppenheimer says many community and regional stakeholders were concerned about the privatization of thousands of acres around Payette Lake,
resulting in development along the lakeshore and limiting public access on what are now state endowment lands that have been managed for decades for public use and accessibility to the lake, as well as for timber harvest and for other public purposes.
Oppenheimer describes what United Payette has in mind for the area.
We are looking at some elements here that could include conservation and recreation leases on some of these lands, potential conservation easements.
Triton has filed a lawsuit against the state alleging bias among a member of the Department of Lands. However, Oppenheimer says the suit's future is unclear. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the nonprofit iUrban Team with Althea Billings. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, clear skies, low down to 54. Tomorrow's weather, mainly sunny skies with a high near 85. The warmer weather lingers for Saturday, then Sunday's highs fall to the low 70s. Today in history, on this date in 1846, German astronomer Johann Gottfried Galle discovered the planet Neptune at the Berlin Observatory. Quote of the day is from Noam Chomsky. He said, either you repeat the same conventional doctrines everybody is saying, or else you say something true, and it will sound like it's from Neptune. Republican leader Senator Mitch McConnell refuses to support raising the debt ceiling. The Biden administration promises $500 million worth of COVID vaccine doses globally. And the U.S. military says it's taking steps to fight sexual assault. For more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Don't play Russian roulette with our economy. Step up and raise the debt ceiling to cover all that you've been engaged in all year long.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell lambasts federal spending. The Kentucky representative is refusing to offer Republican support to raise the nation's debt ceiling and prevent the country from defaulting on its unpaid bills, even though a government shutdown is now on the line. A slew of recent national polls have shown President Biden's approval numbers dipping across the board. And a poll released this week found Biden's approval in Iowa, a traditional swing state, had dropped 12 points since June, down to 31%. Federal Reserve officials expect the nation to end the year with higher unemployment and inflation, along with slower economic growth than they anticipated this summer, according to projections released Wednesday. Ohio Congresswoman Joyce Beatty said she and other members of the Congressional Black Caucus call for a temporary halt of agents relying on horseback at the border, after images appearing to show border agents on horseback driving migrants back to a river like cattle sparked an investigation.
While we respect using horses along the border for safety, for patrolling, we have never witnessed people who look like me to be treated the way those Haitians were.
As it scrambles to deal with the surge of Haitian migrants at the southern border, the Biden administration is seeking a private contractor to operate a migrant detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay. President Biden announced Wednesday the U.S. is purchasing an additional 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to the world as he seeks to boost the global vaccination effort. Meanwhile, Vice President Harris called on the corporate community to contribute to a new global public safety fund that focuses on pandemic preparedness.
Disease surveillance, vaccine development, vaccine delivery, healthcare worker support. Nations need greater capacity.
Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks outlined a timeline and roadmap to implement recommendations from an independent commission's investigation on sexual assaults in the military.
Sexual harassment and sexual assault remain serious problems in our force, with lethal consequences for our service members and harmful effects on our combat readiness.
Former President Trump has filed a $100 million lawsuit against the New York Times and his niece, Mary Trump, over the news outlet's 2018 reporting on his tax records. Trump alleges in his suit that his niece breached a legal agreement by providing confidential information to the Times. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Native advocates are saying the media largely ignores missing and murdered Indigenous women. Native leaders express disappointment in Canada's election, and Red Lake Nation approves a COVID-19 vaccination mandate. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
More than 700 Indigenous people have gone missing in Wyoming in the last 10 years. Native advocates and family members say those cases have not garnered the same media attention or urgency from law enforcement, as the case of Gabby Petito. The young white woman's disappearance in the state, and now her homicide case, continues to make headlines across the country, including stories on national television. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadolska has more.
Lynette Grable is a Northern Arapaho tribal member and leading voice on Wyoming's efforts to address missing and murdered Indigenous women.
It's kind of heartbreaking when we look at a white woman who goes missing and is able to get so much media attention.
Since the year 2000, Indigenous people have made up 21% of homicides in Wyoming, even though only 3% of the population is Indigenous. A report released in January noted that only 30% of Indigenous homicide victims had any media coverage. That number is closer to 51% for whites. Grable adds that solving crimes in Indian country is complicated by a lack of communication between federal and tribal law enforcement.
I think one of the issues that we found is just having all agencies being able to come at the same table and have a conversation. And, you know, that conversation is, how do we work through cross-jurisdictional issues?
She hopes this obvious discrepancy can help missing Indigenous women get the same attention and urgency in the future. I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Some Indigenous leaders are expressing disappointment over Canada's national election. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party was returned to Ottawa, but will have another minority government. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Native leaders say Indigenous issues were largely ignored during the campaign.
Each of the federal parties promised to address Indigenous issues during the election campaign, and there were a record number of Indigenous candidates running for seats. Roseanne Archibald is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. She says she would like to have seen more attention paid to Indigenous issues. In the months ahead of the election, Canadians were shocked by the discovery of thousands of unmarked graves on the grounds of former residential schools in British Columbia and Saskatchewan. But Archibald says that issue was largely ignored during the campaign.
The issue around the recovery of our little children And the fact that it points to and proves what we have said all along, which is that genocide occurred here in Canada, and our children were the target of that. And certainly going into an election with that issue, people wanted to know what these parties were going to do to begin to address that. And they just didn't hear enough of it.
Archibald says her organization offered to hold a leaders' debate on Native issues, but couldn't get the parties to agree. She says Canadians want to see the process of truth and reconciliation accelerated. But some Native leaders are cautiously optimistic that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals will do more for Indigenous communities, especially since they have only a minority and will have to work with the other parties. And she hopes that the left-leaning New Democratic Party will push them to it. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In Minnesota, the Red Lake Tribal Council recently passed a COVID-19 vaccination mandate. The mandate applies to all who enter the reservation for employment or business. The only exceptions are for pregnant women, documented medical conditions, children under 12, or religious practice. According to a press release, no exceptions will be made for philosophical, political, or scientific views. Those who qualify for the exception will be required to get weekly testing. The mandate was passed unanimously by the council. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A federal court rules against elk feed grounds on the traditional lands of Native peoples. As Eric Galatis reports, the court says the U.S. Forest Service overlooked the risk of chronic wasting disease when it handed out permits.
A federal court agreed with conservationists this week that winter feeding of elk on the Bridger-Teton National Forest requires additional environmental review. The court ruled that two feed grounds, Alkali Creek and Forest Park, were not properly permitted, in part because the U.S. Forest Service had not evaluated the potential for disease transmission when large numbers of animals congregate in close quarters. Connie Wilbert directs the Sierra Club's Wyoming chapter.
Chronic wasting disease has now been documented in mule deer and elk right around these feed grounds, and so it's literally on the doorstep.
Chronic wasting disease affects the central nervous system of deer, elk, and moose and is always fatal. Wyoming's powerful livestock industry has pushed to keep winter feed grounds as a tool to mitigate against encounters with wildlife in low elevation ranges and to protect hay stores. Some outfitters also see feed grounds as a way to keep herd numbers high. Wilbert says reliance on feed grounds is both outdated and risks outbreaks of chronic wasting disease throughout the Yellowstone ecosystem, which could wipe out entire herds. She says there are proven alternatives, including fencing, to keep elk away from hay stores.
They want to reduce competition from wildlife for forage. And it's important to know that a lot of that is on public land, and we believe that wildlife should be allowed to access historic winter range.
The court found that the Forest Service improperly permitted feeding elk at Alkali Creek and Forest Park, and that the claims made by the agency in defending its decisions were implausible and unreasonable. The court also ruled that feeding must stop at Dell Creek, which has been operating without a valid permit since 2017. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 23rd, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is in our Fall Fun Drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you would like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
iUrban Teen is a nationally recognized STEM and arts nonprofit for students of color. The nonprofit was founded in Vancouver, Washington, and it's now headquartered in Portland. Dina Pirro started iUrban Teen 10 years ago and has since expanded to offering programs to underrepresented youth in Seattle, Los Angeles, Houston, and Northern California. I spoke to Pirro about her work, its impact, and how the community continues to support iUrban Teen.
Can you tell me a little bit about how the organization started?
I sure can. I love telling this story. You know, I started it because, gosh, over 12 or 13 years ago or more, I was a commissioner here in the state of Washington on the Governor's Commission on African American Affairs. And all of our ethnic commissions were talking about the opportunity gap issue, especially for male youth of color who were not graduating high school, you know, falling through the cracks, marginalization, all of those things that can happen. Clearly, no clear pathways or support mechanisms in place. And so I immediately started looking into my community, at the time was Vancouver, Washington, to see what I can do to put a dent, you know, in this divide. And then I was asked to participate on a Chief Information Officer Council in Portland, Oregon. And so when I went to the very first meeting, I walked into the room and I was it for diversity. It was a room full of white men. And so when I sat down, I started thinking, I said, okay, so over here we have these youth that are being marginalized, disenfranchised, et cetera. But here in this room is where the opportunities are. So how can I bridge this divide? And so 6 months later, I launched iUrban Teen with the help of some of those men in the room who were still supporters of iUrban Teen, because they saw a need, just as I did as well, to create these pathways for students and to STEM and other type of careers that they choose, whatever spark that we create for them, and help them along that pathway.
Very cool. Right. So iUrban Teen offers, you say, career-focused education to underrepresented teens. What kind of programs do youth have access to through iUrban Teen, and what do they get out of it?
Wow. You know, we started, when we first started, we were just having STEM tours, or summit in Portland, and then we started having them in Seattle. They were a full day of experiences where they could see what a career in different fields, in healthcare, in environmental sciences, in technology, in engineering, what that looked like, hands-on experience, fast-paced workshops, etc. Then we expanded to start having STEM tours where we would take students to different companies so they can see firsthand what's the culture of that organization, what are some of the careers there, the people there, those types of things, those other experiences. And then we started expanding to having more programming. So we have a series of after-school programs coming. Let's say we have our coding programs, our iCode programs. We have GIS mapping and machine learning. We have advanced manufacturing supply chain. We have our writing classes that include creative writing, technical writing, screenwriting. We have our engineering camps now. We have our iSpeak program that gives kids the confidence in public speaking, but also how to use your voice for negotiating, for interviewing, those life skills, you know, that are anchored in with them. We also have our trades. Our iTrades program exposes kids to careers in skill trades, because not everyone wants to take the path of working in an office or doing technology. A lot of kids want to get out and do more hands-on work, as such as the trades. We also are just starting a new program in partnership with Microsoft that is for over 18 crowds, so for young adults and older, that is a support engineer opportunity, you know, where we provide 120 hours worth of training. Then they can get certified via Microsoft and actually get employed in careers that are paying $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year. I'm really excited about that program that we're going to launch. We're going to have our first pilot in the latter part of October.
Wow, that's really exciting. So impressive.
I really love the work that we do. And the other thing with us is that we're family-centered. So you might come to our events, any of our events. You might see grandparents with that teen. You might see parents, aunts, uncles, cousins, big brother, big sister. So I always say you honor the family by inviting them in to the organization and to the program. Have them help co-design some of these things that they feel is best suited for their students or for their youth. So, yeah, we've always been family. I think we have probably one of the strongest family engagement programs than others that I know of.
There's an aspect I want to ask about. You touched on it a little bit, helping to address the shortcomings in the school system. Can you talk about how iUrban Teen addresses that?
Well, you know, the thing that we do that I feel is very impactful is more of the social emotional learning pieces, you know, that we do. We build a sense of community, a sense of safety for these students. And we also have enough people in our network to help with even mentoring if needed of different programs. We offer math classes. You know, we have languages. We have all of these things that will help supplement what they may be missing in school. The most important thing for me, too, is when we have our events, we always ask the students at the end of the day, what did we do right by you? And where did we miss the mark? So what did we do right? There's so many rights. But when I hear those students say, I felt valued, that's when I know that we hit the mark. Yes, we want them to know about all these different opportunities. We want them to get the experience in that opportunity. But more so, we want them to feel that they belong to something and they're in a nurturing environment where they matter and where they're seen.
And has iUrban Teen had to adapt or make changes to programs because of the pandemic? Obviously, that's impacted students in a pretty big way.
Yes, we did. Last year, we had to, when all of this first started, you know, we were a little ahead of the game because we started canceling all of our programs that were in person. Within 2 weeks, we created an online platform, our iUrbanTeen.online platform, where we had all of these different programs that they can take online, you know, and for even for some of the students that did not have computers, we would actually pull from our fund and purchase a laptop for them to use so they can take our classes online. So we offered all types of programs. When we opened that online platform up, it was so successful. We started getting students from London, from Tanzania, from Brazil, from Korea, all over the world that was signing on to take our programs that were live with real instructors, no recorded anything. They were building these relationships with other students from around the world.
Wow, that's really remarkable to be able to expand in a time of, you know, contraction in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so it was an amazing year for us. However, I really miss the in-person, the connecting with the students in live sessions, because in our live sessions, the teams are learning in a groupthink type of collaboration or paired learning. We never send them off by themselves somewhere and say, okay, now learn this. It's always in a group collective where they're learning how to build relationships. They're learning how to communicate. They're learning how to work in a team. So that's what I miss most from the in-person to the virtual, because yes, they were building strong relationships with our instructors and other students and all, but it's not like being there in person.
Well, I know there's a fundraiser for iUrban Teen coming up very soon. Can you tell me about that?
Oh my gosh, yes. This is our biggest fundraiser for the year. And it's important for us because everything that we do for these youth is free. We never charge, because I never want cost to be a barrier for these families to be able to participate. So we give first-class, first-rate sessions all for free. But we need to fundraise to make sure that we can continue on this path. Yes, we get grants, but they're usually restricted to only one thing that we can do. So with this Give More 24 campaign, that's an annual day of giving, that's where we can do a lot of our other things, that we can do our, what we call our Bridge the Gap Fund, where we can afford to buy a laptop for a student in need. And especially for this Bridge the Gap program, it goes to fund our students who are actually graduating high school and going to college. But a lot of times, they don't have enough money to even get to their campus if it's across the country, you know, or for their books, or for bus passes, or for a laptop. So this Bridge the Gap Fund that we're hoping we raise, you know, big dollars in this campaign will help fund that and be a cushion for those students. So it's GiveMore24. The website is givemore24.org. And then you can just search for iUrban Teen, two words, iUrban Teen, and go straight to our page. And we have a couple of organizations that have created matches. So if we get enough donations in, then it can make that match and we can get those match dollars as well. So again, this is our biggest fundraiser for the year. GiveMore24.org, do a search for iUrban Teen, two words, and make a donation. Every dollar counts.
So you are obviously a very accomplished person and you've created a very successful nonprofit. Have you encountered misconceptions when doing this kind of work? Are there aspects that you find the general population might misunderstand?
Well, for me, to be honest and be totally transparent, it's always been difficult to be a woman of color, to be a Black female in this space, in this whole tech and STEM space. I was actually honored by President Obama for this program in 2013 and was invited back three more times during his presidency because of this program. But even then, we weren't funded at all. You know, I mentioned that in the White House when they were asking what were some of our challenges. And I said, well, to be honest, mine is funding. I'm a woman of color with a program that's making an impact in the community, but I'm not funded. However, we're here for the long game. You know, our youth are so used to people coming into the community, cherry picking, and then they're gone. That's not us. I could pull a rabbit out of my hat like nobody can. And I was pulling rabbits out for 9 years. It wasn't until Bobby Wagner of the Seahawks learned about us, and he made us his nonprofit of choice with the Seahawks. And it was a contest. He won the contest, and so those dollars came to us. That was the first time that we ever had that kind of funding, you know, and all. And then thankfully, other organizations heard about us, found out, and started sponsoring or giving us grants, which has kept us afloat. But again, this campaign is one of our biggest ones, you know, that we do every year with the Southwest Community Foundation that hosts the Give More 24 program. So I would say my biggest challenges or the misconceptions is that a woman of color can create something this dynamic. Well, a woman of color did create something this dynamic.
Yeah. And so if our listeners are interested in learning more about iUrban Teen or the fundraiser, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way, one, bookmark our website. It's www.iurbanteen.org. They can sign up for our newsletter. They can make donations directly on that page. But however, for this campaign for Give More 24, you actually have, no, wait a minute. I think we have a button now that directs you right to the Give More 24 page on our main site. If you click donate, I think it goes straight there. So again, the website, iurbanteen.org, or the Give More 24 site, givemore24.org, and then do a search for our page. That's two words, iurbanteen.
Very cool. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything I haven't covered?
Well, you know, I think just the final thoughts are for people to understand, you know, how important it is to help create a pathway for our next generation of students coming into this space. And, you know, I also will say that with iUrban Teen, you know, we have an intentional reach, and I say intentional reach, to male youth of color. However, more than 50% of our attendees now in the various cities that we're in, Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Houston, are girls. We also work with youth with disabilities. We have a lot of our students that are on the spectrum. We also have low opportunity white youth in our program. We don't turn away any child that wants to participate and learn. I can't fathom turning away any child. So I think, well, for me, I want people to understand the impact that organizations like iUrban Teen, and there's others, the impact that we're doing and making in the lives of these youth, and they can as well. They don't have to create a program like mine. They can just help support a program like mine.
Well, Dina, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I feel honored to have Beyond KBOO today.
I've been speaking with Dina Pureau, the founder of iUrban Teen. iUrban Teen is a nonprofit aimed at giving students of color career-focused educational opportunities. The organization is part of the Give More 24 fundraiser put on by the Community Foundation for Southwest Washington. It runs through midnight on Thursday, September 23rd. More information can be found online at iurbanteen.org. I'm Althea Billings. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth.
My name is Dr. Mark Allendary, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Ohio judges make vaccines a condition of probation. The New York Times reports that some judges in the state of Ohio have created a strange caveat to incarcerated people released on probation. get a COVID vaccine. This has happened a few times in the state. Some judges are expected to follow suit, creating an ultimatum for people who receive the order: get inoculated within 60 days or risk returning to prison. This is crazy to me. Then this story is crazy because obviously longtime listeners of COVID Noise Filter will know I'm a huge proponent of vaccinations, but they should not be utilized as leverage for whether or not somebody's incarcerated. Really, how serious is the crime? If you're letting somebody out of prison for whatever reason, because they did their time, and you're going to put them back in prison because of whether or not they get vaccinated, it makes a mockery of our criminal justice system. All right, back to our regularly scheduled story. The Ohio judge's decision creates possibly murky waters in terms of permissibility. I'm shocked. But state law in Ohio says judges are allowed to implement any reasonable conditions that serve to rehabilitate or protect the community. Some states have instituted similar, albeit less extreme, measures. In Georgia, judges have offered reduced sentences for defendants who get vaccinated. Again, I support people getting vaccinated. Of course I do. But you reduce sentences for defendants who get vaccinated? How about no sentences, right? I mean, this to me, it shows how subjective the criminal justice system is. And to me, this story is very hard for me to read. I actually pitched this story at our pitch meetings. It's so hard because it just shows how unjust the criminal justice system is. All right, back to our regularly scheduled story. While there's obviously a strong case for the vaccine being a reasonable measure to protect the community, it's unlikely that it would be held up if challenged. According to Michael Benza, a senior instructor at Case Western School of Law, the orders have gone unchallenged so far, but would likely be found improper if a defendant did challenge it. One judge who required vaccinations defended the decision by saying the judges often create conditions related to health, like drug and alcohol treatment. The UK's antibody surveillance program. The British government has announced its plans to begin an antibody surveillance program for adults who tested positive for COVID-19, with the rollout happening immediately. Keeping track of the virus and its transmission and effects have been a key aim for governments globally, and the UK government hopes that this program will allow them to develop a better understanding of its vaccine campaign and people's immune responses to the different variants of the virus. Aiming to find out more about how much natural protection people get after getting COVID-19, the program will allow for 8,000 participants per day, sending finger prick antibody tests for free to those who have tested positive for the virus. The program involves two tests, one to be done as soon as possible after a positive result in order to determine antibody levels before the infection. The second, within another 28 days to measure antibodies that have developed in response to the infection. The data collected will be used for a range of purposes, including helping to gauge the proportion of people who were infected with the virus despite having developed antibodies as a result of having a vaccine or having caught COVID in the past, as well as breakthrough cases. It will also help to study those who don't mount much of an immune response and whether this has any correlation to a specific demographic of people. The UK Health Security Agency will be running the program alongside the National Health Service Test and Trace System, and its chief executive, Dr. Jenny Harries, has stated that it would help the UK gain vital insight into the impact of the vaccination program and immune responses to different variants. Programs like this are hugely beneficial in order to continue to assess the impact of the pandemic and update our knowledge of how the virus affects the body and immune responses. Getting vaccinated is key to protecting ourselves, and research on this scale will tell us what kind of antibody responses vaccines provide in addition to an actual COVID infection, and help inform future public policy making on COVID-19 treatment. child mental health and the pandemic. Research suggests that the mental health of children and adolescents under the age of 18 has worsened since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. With the pandemic interrupting almost all aspects of normal life for young children, from going to school every day and gaining vital social interactions for development and well-being, to enduring economic stress on families and potentially grieving for lost ones, mental health has suffered. A team of researchers from the University of Calgary has analyzed 29 studies of children's mental health during the pandemic, including over 80,000 children and adolescents globally, to attempt to find concrete data on the statistics of children's mental health. The researchers looked at studies from between January 2020 to February of 2021, utilizing four databases of information to pool all the data. The study estimates that both child and adolescent clinical depression and anxiety levels were elevated, with 1 in 4 youth globally experiencing elevated depression symptoms and 1 in 5 experiencing anxiety symptoms. When compared to pre-pandemic estimates, the researchers suggested that the prevalence of depression and anxiety symptoms doubled during the pandemic. Isolation is also likely a major factor in the decline of well-being for many. Schools are often primary locations for receiving psychological services, which online learning cannot provide. Depression and anxiety levels among youth were higher amongst girls and older adolescents, and higher rates of these symptoms were recorded the longer the pandemic went on. The Washington Post states that at least on one count, there were on average just under 10 U.S. child psychiatrists per 100,000 children under the age of 19. The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry states that 4 times that amount are truly needed. Psychiatrists tend to congregate in big cities, and more than 2/3 of the U.S. counties don't have a child psychologist. Greater allocation of resources is needed to address child and adolescent mental health, both during the pandemic and after, in order to rehabilitate children and assist their mental recovery. The diversity of the children surveyed globally highlights that these children will require different interventions for their mental health based on age, gender, or location, and it is imperative that our children receive this care. Monoclonal antibody treatments. The FDA's approval last year for the emergency use of monoclonal antibodies to help treat coronavirus has been largely overlooked amidst the mass vaccination rollout and other preventative measures. However, the White House COVID-19 response team has reported that over 500,000 people have received the treatment since November of 2020, with this number continuing to rise. So, what are monoclonal antibodies? These antibodies are lab-made proteins that mimic the body's immune response to fight off threats such as COVID-19. As the body can take time to mount its own immune response and the production of antibodies, this treatment can speed up the body's ability to fight infection while the immune system is mounting its natural response to the virus. This means that it's best to receive the treatment as soon as possible after showing symptoms and testing positive for COVID-19. The treatment can prevent severe disease if taken within 7 to 10 days of symptoms beginning, helping to reduce hospitalizations. Monoclonal antibody treatments are only available to people age 12 and over who are not severely ill, hospitalized, or on supplemental oxygen, and both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals can receive the treatment. The FDA has approved it as a preventative treatment for those who have been exposed to the virus and are at higher risk for complications. And in late July, this has also applied to high-risk environments such as nursing homes and prisons. Florida has begun rolling out mobile units to administer the treatment to COVID-19 patients as cases continue to spike in the state. However, administering the treatment faces logistical issues as its delivery can be complicated and costly for medical facilities, in addition to the general difficulties created by the pandemic in providing any kind of care. The treatment requires intravenous infusion, and that can take up to an hour to drip the medicine into the patient, or 4 injections for the Regeneron treatment can also be used. Medical personnel must stay with the patient another hour to ensure that they do not have any serious reactions, which many private healthcare professionals do not have the capacity to facilitate. In fact, Dr. Anthony Fauci has stated that monoclonal antibody treatments are much underutilized, citing that research indicates that they can reduce the risk of hospitalizations between 70 to 85%, while some health officials believe that other measures should be prioritized, such as masking vaccination to help prevent the disease in the first place. Helping to treat people who face the infection is essential to beating the pandemic and saving as many lives as possible. And on a personal note, let me just say that of all the things that I have seen with respect to COVID and treating COVID, aside from dexamethasone, which is a steroid we give to people who have COVID, I'm telling you, these monoclonal antibodies work amazingly well. Amazingly well. So if you've been exposed to COVID or you yourself have COVID and before you progress to getting severe COVID symptoms, go out, go to your local ER and figure out how you can get those monoclonal antibodies. And Florida is doing a great job rolling them out. They're pretty much everywhere, my understanding is, which is good because so is COVID.
Just as a reminder, that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.